Yes, second class on this short 6-week course, Balancing Emotions. So it's based on Buddhist psychology. And in it, we're attempting to pretty much look at life, the universe, and everything through the lens of how on earth to be happy and make our life meaningful in 6 short weeks, no less. Every now and again, I'll throw in some Western psychology or knowledge and try and see where it fits in with Buddhism, where there's similarities, where there's differences, just so that we can orient ourselves and further investigate. And hopefully it's going to be useful just if you're a human being. Doesn't matter if you're Buddhist or not, religious or not, beliefs or no beliefs. We're all human. We all experience really fundamentally similar kind of issues, and there is something that we can do about them. What we've covered so far. Also, hello to the online people. Madonna's going to be looking after you and going to be our intermediary if you have questions. What we've covered so far, last week, we looked at the three types of happiness identified by the Buddha. Does anyone remember what they were? Just roughly in your own words. Hedonistic ones, that's right. We're pretty familiar with that. I'm pretty familiar with that. Eudaimonic, hard word to say. That's right. I sometimes think, oh, it's coming up. I better say it. I wonder what's going to come out of my mouth. But yeah, that's right. A lesser known word, but to do with happiness that isn't just dependent on the senses, but it's dependent on us, our being. And the other one, the big long, that's the Buddhist one, the what you will become. That's right. So the bliss of the stages of enlightenment, which is as we actually change, as we dismantle our negative habit patterns, as we strengthen all of our positive qualities. So we've got all the comfort of sensual enjoyments and pleasures, hedonism. And the Buddha nature is how come we can actually develop and actually progress and step by step get there. If we didn't have the potential, Buddha nature, or the potential to wake up. So comfort, meaning, contributing to society, letting go of negative emotions, states of deep concentration, a flow state, I think is the psychological term. And then the happiness of real freedom. So freedom from being beholden to what's happening to us, because we've tamed our mind and we have confidence. And that is a continuous thing. We don't have to put a limit on that until complete freedom, which is the Buddhist word is nirvana, complete freedom from the ups and downs of cyclic existence, or even enlightenment. Then we had some a happiness worksheet, and part of that was the reflection sheets and the gratitude journal. And I was interested to hear like what people put down on their happiness journal. Out of these three types of things to be happy about, so that's kind of like from last week, this way of reflecting things that we're grateful for, which is usually things that have happened to us that we feel real gratitude, we feel how lucky, but also then things that we can rejoice about, especially our own efforts. And so did you have any of those two in your? Yes. Okay. Tell me some of them. Oh, so either the ones of what you feel grateful for, the things that have happened. Yeah. Well, that could be a bit of both, couldn't it? Because if you also put effort into zipping your lip and not being triggered and saying the right thing and thinking about it beforehand, that's actually a big act of generosity. Yeah. So enjoying the really harmonious, yeah, family. Who else has got one? Oh, okay. Yeah. So instead of, oh no, the weeds are back, dang, it's how wonderful to have a garden. And did that make a difference? Yeah. Housework. Well spotted. Yes, Anne. Yay for the garbage collection. Yeah, well, they do say micro civilization is like how good the sewage system is. And me with my horror of camping, like I really appreciate Nice bathroom. Yeah, Madonna. Oh, air conditioning. Everybody's nodding. So all of those things, if we bother to notice, then just they're very mundane, aren't they? But just noticing them, we're already feeling so much better. Yeah. Well, yes, so one of them, because a lot of the time where we're dissatisfied, it's because we're focusing on the everything that's wrong, like you're saying, the weeds. And so we think we have to change that, but actually we're going to change what we're focusing on. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that once we start feeling gratitude, what's that? What are we actually feeling? Like it's a good feeling, isn't it? And
Peaceful feeling.
it's peaceful. And what else about it?
It's not a joy.
It's joyous, it's peaceful, and it's thankful. And so it involves others. We're feeling thankful for the efforts of others. Or in the Buddhist terminology, it's the kindness of others, the kindness of mother sentient beings, or the kindness of sentient beings, which I've always thought, well, no, excuse me, look around you, nobody's being kind. But it's this level of how everything that we enjoy comes from the efforts of others. Yeah. What about the other one, the type of which we can call rejoicing, which is where you appreciate what you've contributed or the effort you put in. Did anyone write any of those down? Yeah, so that's a heap of work and then being in the flow state. And so that's almost like yes, the feeling of satisfaction afterwards. Yeah. Great. Yep. Anyone else? Singing's got a whole it's got a huge amount in it. It's both. It's because it's a sensual thing. It's something that we do, and it's dependent on our ordinary senses, our ordinary day-to-day relationships, but it does something much more than that. And that's what's so good about singing, that it connects us to others, and it's literally creating harmony. And that's why it's so much more than just like you can all sing and you can all sing completely out of tune, but it's still going to be a very moving experience because it is literally creating harmony amongst a group of people, and that in itself is healing. And then actually the fantastic thing about singing is that when you sing, all your heartbeats start synchronizing. And so you might notice it. I haven't been in a choir, but I've noticed when we've had prayers and everyone's singing, and then suddenly it all clicks in and you feel like now you're whole singing. And that's when everybody clicks into the same state, and that's when everybody's heartbeats have been synchronized. Same thing happens with musicians in an orchestra. Okay. Great. And any other questions or comments about the happiness journal? Anything to add? Or I think verbally is fine, to actually just turn your mind to it. But there is something about if you want to make really big changes, is to write it down, because it's really like sign on the dotted line. It's an activity. So it's not just saying it, it's another level of locking it in. And so we don't have to think about it. It just makes it more important. So we can use that. So a lot of people make pledges, and so they sign. So once you've signed, yeah, but you also get a loop happening. So same thing. I recently did a collage workshop, and it's again, you have ideas, but then you put them out there, and that's one thing. The great thing about collage is you don't have to be able to draw. So, but then the collage kind of reflects back at you. So, by doing that activity, it's much stronger. Anyway, I'm pretty sure if Corey Jackson has spoken a bit about that too, there's a whole deep neurological thing going on as well to explain it. All right. So excellent. So today we're going to continue on, with the happiness journal. We get an idea about how it's a habit. It's changing our habit to start at least recognizing the good things as well as the bad things. And it does take effort to recognize good things. It doesn't happen naturally. So then looking at habits, how come it's really easy to have bad habits? We don't have to go now concentrate on that bad habit and make sure you just do it every day. And so why are they so hard to break? Why are positive ones, why do they take effort? And what we can do about it. So what we can do to change negative habit patterns. So I put up here a picture of a lotus because one of my favorite sayings, no mud, no lotus. So out of all of the difficulty will come a huge amount of benefit if we put the effort in. And a lot of our negative habits and our old traumas can become something that we draw on that can become beneficial. And then we can flourish as a human being. And so for those of you online, there's two questions just to jot down just before we set our motivation, just to get you thinking. So one is, what are you doing at the moment that you want to stop doing? Just one thing. You know, we're here, we obviously we've got some destructive habit patterns, so just pick one. And usually those things will come to mind and we'll have a whole list. But the second question is, what are you not doing that you would like to be doing? You know, sometimes those important things, we just put them off and off and off and off. Ah, not on me, no. Are we? So I like to start with a question like this, just so that when we go through the class, you've got something in mind that's actually personal to you. Okay, so if you've got a bit of an idea, have you? So adjust your posture so that your spine is relatively straight. Imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through the center of your body and coming out the crown of your head. And feel as if you're supported by this thread of light from your crown. Feel the weight of your body suspended, nicely supported. And then let your neck release, the shoulders drop. Take a couple of deep breaths. And as you bring your focus inwards, try and notice your feeling tone for tonight, as if you were a weather reporter. So without judging it as good or bad, just describing your feeling tone. How do you feel at this moment? Is it a pleasant feeling tone? Is it a bit agitated or restless? Is it neutral? As you have your focus inwards, being aware of the breath, you become aware of that internal environment. Notice if you feel different now than from when you first arrived. From earlier on in the day. If there's also a storyline that comes along with that feeling, try and let go of the storyline. Just become aware of the raw feeling without any story, any judgment, even deciding if it's good or bad, worthwhile or not worthwhile. Notice it more as a texture. And if you're feeling neutral, then recognize that as a calm baseline to be able to direct the mind in whatever way that we choose. If you're a bit uncomfortable or agitated, recognize it as like a weather system that it arises, but it'll also dissipate. It's a result. Doesn't mean anything bad. And if you're feeling quite good or buoyant, let yourself enjoy that feeling without grasping after more or worrying about if it finishes. Just enjoy it while it's there, like a pleasant day. And then thinking about the thing that you're doing at the moment that you want to stop doing, the things that you'd like to be doing or know you should be doing that you've been putting off. Have that as the starting point of our motivation, and then we can expand it out to set a real determination in our mind to support and develop all the positive habit patterns that can support happiness and support a meaningful life. And that this is possible, and that if we do, then we can bring lasting happiness to ourselves and to everyone around us. So, with this motivation, take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Okay, so let's dive in. And you did mention just before about Buddha nature. And so, from a Buddhist psychology point of view, when we look at the nature of our mind, by nature, it's clear or pure, unsullied, like the sky. But as you can see from these two very dominating chimney stacks, there's something else that's happening here, which is that we're pumping in all sorts of disturbances and agitations and panics. And reactivity and being judgmental and all of the disturbing emotions that overtake us, and that's like pumping this pollution into our inner atmosphere all the time. And so sometimes we can have so much pollution in there, someone says, "Oh, the mind's naturally pure," and we just go, "Yeah, right." Not possible. And if any of you have lived in a place, say like Melbourne, where they'll have months and months and months with just clouds in the sky, no blue sky. Like there's a whole syndrome for it called SAD, seasonal affective disorder, which is what happens when you never get to see blue sky or the sun. So I've lived in Melbourne a couple of times in my life, and it's really depressing. And you don't realize that that's what's happening, this real oppression. Until the first sunny day, and suddenly all of the introverted, grumpy Melbourneites are there in the sun, chatting in the park, all happy, happy. So it's until we actually have an experience of it, we really can't believe it. So all of the disturbing states of mind that we have, it's not that we're a bad or worthless person, it's that where our mind is contaminated by disturbing emotions, distorted states of mind, prejudices and negative habit patterns. So our mind, it's polluted with clouds of toxic emotions. And if we want to be happy, we have to stop pumping any more in. That's the minimum. So it's hard enough to do with the climate, let alone with our own mind. I think probably the two are actually quite linked together. And it is actually possible to do this. And just like we saw when there were all the lockdowns in COVID, and I saw those photographs of like dolphins in the canals in Venice and the blue skies, like there it was. And it was only a few days, wasn't it? So the Buddha found a way that we can actually stop pumping in those toxic emotions and then start cleaning our mind, cleaning out all of the negative stuff. That's what enlightenment is. Enlightenment isn't some kind of abracadabra or Zen moment or turning into a Buddha. It's actually this, just removing that inner toxicity from the mind. So the nature of our mind is the same as the Buddha's. That's the thing. It's not like the Buddha was some different kind of being and so could become enlightened. He was like us. And we've got the same, starting point, a body and a mind. So the Buddha was able to do it. The nature of our mind is the same as the Buddha's, therefore we also have the potential. This is like the context of Buddhist psychology, and it's quite different from Western psychology. I think the prevailing approach of Western psychology is to just make do with what we have, and this idea that somehow all of the disturbing states of mind are part of us and there's nothing that we can do. But actually, the states of mind like love and compassion and empathy, they're deeper than all of those negative states of mind. They're actually part of our nature. And all of the aggression and disturbance comes as a reaction to pain or fear. So they're overlays, they're on the top. They're not some part of us that we can't do anything about. And even with wild animals, you take away the threatening environment and the wild animals stop being aggressive. And they don't have any beliefs. They just behave. That's just how they behave. So it's a really profound thing, and it's something worth coming back to again and again because I think it really clouds how we approach our life when we think somehow we're not good enough or we can't do it. So, what happens though, even if this is the context, what happens is we conflate people with their behavior. So, if someone does a bad thing, we think they are a bad person. So I've put, is he Monty Burns from The Simpsons? Yeah. Like I look at him and I just think bad person. There's no way I can think a person just like me who's, really convoluted and got terrible baggage and a bad history and whatever. I just think, ugh. So this is because we think the person is their behavior. And what we forget, we've got to bring our attention to, is that actually they're overwhelmed by their afflictive emotions and their disturbances. And this is the result. Yeah, so hating the behavior and not the person, easy to say, incredibly difficult to do, takes a huge amount of mindfulness, both emotionally, but also the way we frame it and use our words. So the class where we talk about speech patterns in particular, this is one of them. So I've got some just some examples for you. So a physical one, we talk about someone, say they're an alcoholic. My friend who's an alcoholic is one way that we conflate the person and the behavior, isn't it? And we say it all the time and we get worried about them all the time. But there's another way we can frame it. He's my brother who suffers from alcoholism. So it's different, isn't it? It frames it differently. Just recently, there was a show on telly with what's the Miriam Margolyes. So she said, it's not that you're fat, it's that you have obesity. I thought, Anya, Miriam, that's right. But it makes a difference, doesn't it? Compartmentally, you are this or you are that, then you become all of that and nothing else. Whereas if you have it, if you have alcoholism or if you have a mental illness, not that you are mental, it's a whole different way. Here's another one. Oh, she's a nag, or she's my friend who can't control her speech. Or, as it has happened many times in my life, an angry neighbor. What else can we say about an angry neighbor? Just so that they're not just everything about them is the angry neighbor, like they came out of their mother's womb like that. What's a way that we could frame it that's different? They're suffering, yep.
He's frustrated with the urban environment.
Frustrated with the urban environment, yes. Parrot. My neighbor has Buddha potential. So, yeah, this is what I wrote. He's old and filled with rage. Which, I mean, now, like, it just softens everything, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, personally, have a giggle when it's right in front of you. Well, not so much of a giggle, but it's understandable then. So all of these things are like destructive behaviors. When we see them in others, we think they are just that, and we start calling people by that name. So those behaviors can really start to identify us. So let's have a look then at, well, what is a habit? So habit is an acquired behavior that done repeatedly, and sometimes repeatedly, not that many times, it becomes involuntary or automatic. So then it's a habit. Doesn't take that long. Anything that we do repeatedly becomes a habit. Some things take longer than others. So a negative habit is a lot more than just something that is obviously destructive for us, that harms our health or our emotional well-being or harms others. There's another element to it, which is a negative habit takes us away from something beneficial. So Corey Jackson has often talked about negative habits and how we're neurologically wired to notice the negative first and to remember the losses and the problems first and easily. And it takes effort to remember the good things. So if you've ever played cards, everybody remembers the one they lost. But you hardly ever remember the time you won. But the one that you lost, it's just like a wound that's continuously there. So we're biologically hardwired to do that, to remember the times things went wrong, because that keeps us alive. So we think back to the party we went to, and what do we remember? The one stupid thing we said instead of all the great conversations we had. And that is automatic. So once you know that's automatic and it's actually not the reality, you'll be able to relax and go, oh yeah, that's just the automatic thing. Now let's just spend a little bit of effort remembering the good things. If we're not aware of that, we'll fixate on that negative thing and we'll think it's important. Because our attention is there, then we necessarily think it's a big thing. So negative habits take us away from something beneficial. And for instance, all of the kind of distraction and avoidance that we do to try and avoid a situation. So many times I've just like, no, now's not a good time. Because we don't want to feel the bad thing. And so then what happens is we don't deal with it. And then it gets worse. So that kind of negative habit, while you're just putting things off, you're not actually doing anything overtly wrong or bad, but it's taking you away from something beneficial. And that is a cumulative thing. And many times our habits are actually just habitual responses to things. Like you were saying about the gardening, if you're the, and I'm the kind of person too that goes, oh no, before I go, oh yay. So that's a, it's just a habit. So the question What are we actually practicing now then? Because a whole lot of things that we practice are just habits. Like we practice being negative, or we practice being depressed or anxious. It's the thing that we do as a habit. The quote from last week, happiness is nothing more than a few simple disciplines practiced every day. While misery is simply a few errors of judgment and bad habits repeated every day. So now, questions, comments, anything come to mind? Is it a different way of thinking about things that our habits are like our practice, our default practice? Yeah, that's right. Short-term enjoyable,
Yes.
undoubtedly, yes. And I think also, like with drinking, so they say once you start drinking by yourself, because with then that's like a danger sign. And I think also, like drinking, it's quite a it's a tricky one, because half of it is the social part, and that's about connection, but it's got this other bit in it that's not so healthy. And if we can't figure out those two are quite separate things, then we can actually have the connection. It took me, I've got to say, when I stopped drinking, it took me a long time to be able to socialize without drinking, because I just actually didn't know what to do. They just went together.
Of today.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Oh, I hear you. Yes, the habit of worry, and then waking up, and then like it's great. Scan, like just like you say, scanning. What am I dreading today? What's Yeah, so that's really interesting. What's on high alert? So what we can do there is separate the feeling of the anxiety and the scanning from the actual factual what's happening, the contents, the appointments, or the this or the that. So we think they go together, that we're feeling the anxiety because of the appointments. But actually, that's just random. It could be anything. And in fact, every now and again, we wake up and we just feel the anxiety, and then we have to search for the thing that's making it. And it's like, oh, there it is. That's I remember now what I'm really anxious about. Well, from the that's yes. So the habit of worry, it's like a practice. It's like a default practice that we have. And this is the thing, that habits, if left alone like that, they just get stronger. They don't go away. And we kind of like put them aside, thinking, oh, maybe it'll wear off. But it doesn't. It becomes such an entrenched habit that then, in a way, like if you're like me, then you've got to actually just use anxiety as part of your toolbox, because it's never going to go away because it's so entrenched. Yeah, Madonna. Yes, habits are comforting. They provide certainty, familiarity. So we go, ah, oh, there, my old friend, anxiety. And then you just hook arms and off you go together. Yeah, that's right. So again, that's like a negative habit that takes us away from something beneficial, because yeah, it's familiar, where it's a well-worn track, but there's so many other ways we could be doing it that would be more enjoyable for us and more beneficial. But we go for just the familiarity because we know it. Yeah, that's right. So then it becomes part of your identity, and then it becomes a feedback loop like that. This is the kind of person I am. So if I don't have my anxiety, who am I? And now there's the big space opens up. So in Buddhism, that's the fantastic question, because the who am I and the space opening up is a good thing. In the rest of the world, it's seen as a horror. And why? Because they don't have an answer or context for it. But actually, having that question, well, then if I don't have this, who am I? And then sitting with that spaciousness, that's part of the healing process. But it's very interesting you said that, because here's the quote. I love this quote. Watch your thoughts, because for they become your words. Watch your words, for they become your actions. Watch your actions, for they become your habits. Watch your habits, for they become your character. And watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. And I think you could even go on and say, watch your destiny, because it becomes our whole society. Our society. So we've got from, this is quite a detailed quote, I think the Buddha said about who we are comes from what we think. So it starts with the thoughts, it ends up with our actions. Our actions are karma, which is habit, and then that has consequences, whether we're aware of them or not. And that creates our destiny. So we can change it. But our destiny also, not just for us, but then for the next generation, intergenerational trauma, and then that changes society. So it's a really big deal. Our habits end up really defining us without us planning it that way at all. So this quote, I put this into Snopes to try and find who actually said this particular quote, because it's so good. And it's some inventor of a supermarket chain. It's just it summarizes what the Buddha said, and it's true. There it is. Yeah, if it's a habit of being depressed or anxious, even if it feels bad, we keep repeating it, because it's like an addiction. The more we become familiar with it, the more likely we are to go back to it, whether it's pleasant or not. It gives us a short-term security, because certainty, a short-term certainty, so we know what's going to happen, rather than a long-term possibility of which we have no control over and don't know what's going to happen. So again, it takes us that settling for the familiar disturbance takes us away from something really beneficial. So yes, our habits end up defining us. No one sets out to be a cranky person or an alcoholic. No one ever goes, what are you going to be when you grow up? It's never something that we plan, and yet it happens, and then it determines actually our whole life. Yeah, the probabilities, if you're negative, not just your kids, but everyone around you, your workplace, your friends. If you're negative at a workplace, yeah, you can get ostracized, but you can also, when everybody else is dissatisfied, then you huddle. Yeah, it can be quite toxic. So you need to have someone that's really on the ball to recognize it and change the behavior and the workplace habit or culture, so it doesn't get toxic like that. And we can see the difference, can't we? Just by work walking into a workplace, you can tell. So Lama Yeshe says, so this is from the peaceful stillness of the silent mind. Through meditation, you can discover how even actions of body and speech are psychologically motivated. This discovery leads you to natural control of all your actions. An understanding of your psychological impulses is all you need to become your own psychologist. You should know or investigate every aspect of your own life. Your life will be more integrated, and you'll see things more clearly. A partial view of life can only make you insecure. So I think also that just holding on to the familiar is like that partial view of life. There are many types of psychological impulse driving you to do what you do. Some of these are positive, others negative. Instead of simply doing whatever your impulses dictate, it's better to step back and ask why. Observing your mind is much more interesting than watching TV. Once you've seen your mind, you'll find television boring. Checking in detail what you've been doing from the time when you were born. Not so much your physical actions, but the psychological impulses driving you to do them is extremely interesting, and is how to become familiar with the way your internal world functions. Analyzing your own mind with your knowledge wisdom makes you mentally healthy. It's how you discover that your enjoyment does not depend on chocolate. You can be happy and satisfied without chocolate. So that's the first type of the happiness, isn't it? So normally you tend to believe, oh, as long as I have chocolate, I'll be happy. But I can't be happy without it. You make your own philosophy of life with this kind of determination, which comes from attachment. Then, when the chocolate disappears, you get nervous. Oh no, now I'll be unhappy. But it's not the absence of chocolate that is making you unhappy, it's your fixed ideas. It's the way your mind tricks you into believing that your happiness depends on the external objects. It's your psychological impulses that make you mentally ill. People get homesick, don't they? Well, here's a new type of illness, choc sick. So, happiness is also a habit. And this is interesting because normally we think happiness is something that happens to us, which is that first level of happiness, what we get from the world. But actually, that lasting happiness can't come from outside of us. And the inner happiness is actually an activity of mind, and it's a practice. And so, in that way, it's just a practice that if we do it enough, it'll come naturally. So then we'll be naturally open and positive and peaceful and confident and all of those things. So it's something we can train in. And with training, it'll become easier to develop virtue than negativity. So there is actually a point where we put in all of this initial effort, and it takes effort, say to not retaliate when someone's being unskillful with their speech, or to not even retaliate in our mind. And so we try and bring all the mindfulness to it, and remember the person is not their behavior and all of this. And then after a while, that will come naturally. And so then there's a point where you come across a disturbed or agitated negative person, and your natural response will be compassion rather than recoiling. So naturally, a positive state of mind will come up. So that's the minimum we can be aiming for. And so if we aim at this, what we have then is a baseline of what I call realistic optimism. So it is realistic. It's not like a wish. It's not like wishful thinking. It's realistic because it understands the nature of our mind and what our potential is and the potential of everybody else. So, how on earth do we get started with a happiness habit? Well, three things: with the mind, the credit, gratitude journal, or the happiness journal. That habit alone, turning our mind to positive things, if that becomes an ingrained habit, we will always have a happy mind. And I mean, this is what people do in war, isn't it? When you hear people come back from war zones, this is how they just focus on the things that they're incredibly grateful about, or come back from like fires or floods. At least the family's okay, or at least we saved the horses, and they're not thinking, oh no, I've lost the family home. So that habit is a really big one that will help. In terms of actions, the pay it forward, anytime something fantastic happens to you or someone shows you kindness, pay it forward. So as something to do physically. So I like, for instance, we've got this pile of groceries, which when we have pujas and offering ceremonies, we make lots of offerings. But since COVID era, we've made all of these offerings. It's not chips and chocolate anymore. It's healthy things. And so once they've been blessed and offered, then they go off to a community kitchen. So paying it forward. And so when I was in my 20s, I think I hadn't ever bought any new clothes. Everything I had came from the op shop, and I had really good op shop karma. And so then when I actually started growing out of my clothes, then instead of like hoarding them, I was like, I'm going to give them back to the op shop. I'm going to give good clothes back to the op shop. Okay. And for the speech, giving compliments. The best way to give a compliment is not just to say, oh, you look nice, but to actually say a detail about it. So it shows that you've actually paid some attention. And compliments. You can note it, like I notice things about people, but time goes by so fast, doesn't it? You don't get a chance to say it. So I think it's part of a habit is to put the effort in to give the compliment. So give the compliment not just about how people look, but hey, gee, you handled that well. Gee, you handled that person well. Those kind of things to recognize others' virtue, others' good qualities. They're the kind of things that we have to bring our attention and focus to. Because everybody else brings our attention and focus to the terrible things in the news and all of those things. So the giving the compliments to actually help bring others' minds to their own good qualities is really important. Because also for ourselves too, we know that if somebody else compliments us on our character, it's a really big deal, isn't it? Really, it means something. Yeah. Are you a bit cold? Do we need to turn the aircon off? Yeah, everyone's. You're all right? Okay. Just checking.
Oh,
All right. So before we go on to the neurology of a habit cycle, how are we tracking with this happiness as a habit, as an activity? It is easier to feel down also just because neurologically that's the first thing we go to, and then if we're unaware of the process, we'll just stay there. Yep. But also the feeling happy, again, it's like it depends on your definition of happy, because does happy mean having a good time, or does happy mean having purpose? Or does happy mean, well, everything's gone pear-shaped, but at least yesterday I was able to help somebody? So it's quite a range of things when we think about happy. And most of the time we've associated happy with being entertained, which after a while wears off, doesn't it? I mean, all those favorite songs. No longer. Yes, yes, yes. You do, you feel lighter. But also I think that lightness comes from, I really think it comes from having a feeling of purpose and direction. And in a way that gives us a sense of familiarity and certainty. This is what I'm doing. Because that, oh no, what am I doing with my life question can just seep away all of our energy. It is, and we've been trying to find our purpose since we were kids, and our parents would said, or their uncles and aunts said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then somewhere along the line they stopped encouraging you to be an astronaut. But if we can't find that purpose, it's going to be gnawing away at us. And things won't, it just won't be enough. So let's have a look, the neurology of a habit cycle. So we're going to have a look at the negative one, which is called feeding the monster. And so this is how the habits happen step by step. And the next slide, we'll have a look at how, therefore, we can dismantle them step by step. Because changing a habit, you just can't do it through willpower alone. It's not enough. If we just try and change our habits just by force of will, that will only last as long as we have energy. But the moment we get sick or have a down day, or don't have enough sleep, or have a sugar rush and a sugar crash, it all goes out the window, which is why people get cranky when they have the flu because the extra energy of the willpower goes. So it really has to be a changing of the whole process, there's bits that we can do each step along the way. So the first thing that happens, which isn't necessarily the first thing that we recognize, but we have all the input that comes in. So the sense data, whether it's noisy, whether it's a pleasant environment, how you wake up in the morning, whether you wake up with panic or just leisurely and happy, or whether the dog's licking your face, or whether you're late, whatever it is. All of the input, all of the emotions that arise, and which is like an internal input as well, memories. Our environment, external environment and internal environment. So that is assaulting us all the time, and most of the time we're not aware of it, but we react. So we either think we like it or dislike it, it's pleasant or it's unpleasant, and we believe it. So if we wake up with anxiety in the morning, we go, oh, bad feeling, don't like it. So already there's a story involved in it. But it's a deceptive brain message. A lot of what we feel, it's a feeling that's valid, but what it's telling us is not true. So I put an alarm clock there because this is how trauma works, that you have input that comes in, like the dinging of a bell, and then you have the whole trauma response, the alarm, and that's a physiological response, but it's a deceptive message. It's got nothing to do with what's happening around. And if we believe it, if physiologically it overwhelms us, then we're in real trouble. So I've got a couple of my favorite examples for this of the deceptive brain messages. So one of them, has anyone ever had a craving for sugar? Okay, so apparently when you crave sugar, it's because you are low in protein. How about that? So there is a deceptive brain message. You just want something sweet, but it actually means you're low in protein. And ironically, of course, then we go and have something sweet. So that doesn't help, does it? So then the whole cycle. So all of the fast food chains know this whole cycle intimately, which is why they get you to buy the fizzy drink, then the salty meat, and then the creamy thing. And then you have to do it again. Yep. It's all full of sugar. And that also does well, because then you get the sugar high and all of those things. But the fact that you think it, you want something sweet, and so that's called an appearance. You're absolutely dead set certain what you want is a sweet thing. No, it's a deceptive brain message. Not going to say that in the
gobba.
So we have that. And so then, of course, so then if we go like, oh, I just really want something sweet. So then we have this urge to relieve the discomfort of this feeling of like the sweet tooth, this craving. So with that urge, then we, so this, the urge to relieve that discomfort can be either wanting the thing, or it can be panicking and putting it away, pushing it away. So often with our emotions, when difficult emotions arise, we don't want them. We think, oh, difficult emotion, the deceptive brain message says bad emotion, and then we go, don't want it. Whereas actually, a lot of emotions like dread and anxiety, when they come up, they're a result of something going on. They're like a warning light that we should listen to. But we just go, oh, it feels bad, don't want it, and try and do anything to push it away. Distract ourselves, do something that's fun or entertaining, or drink ourselves into oblivion or whatever it is, because we believe the deceptive brain message, which is it feels bad, therefore it is bad. And that's just not true. Even our pain system in our body. I've got these special shoes that I call my art gallery shoes because normally I try and get all nice and dressed up for the art gallery because you dress for the art. And so then I walk around the art gallery in my snazzy clothes and my snazzy shoes, and I come home and I take my shoes off, and my feet are just bloodied with blisters. And I'm like, how does this happen? And it's because there's something that's going, oh, bad feeling, like, no, not paying any attention. So a bad feeling, your pain system is there to protect you. And if you don't listen to it, then you end up with all of these scars all over your feet and blisters. So either pushing it away, trying to ignore it, or craving, trying to grasp it. Either way, we're trying, that's the urge to relieve this discomfort. And so we just do that a few times and it becomes an automatic, habitual, unhealthy response. So I put a thing of cigarettes there because so for about, I don't know, 15 years or so, I was a really heavy smoker. So the stress, want to resolve the stress, have a cigarette. Then the stress is relieved. And so then you associate that with the cigarette. So not only that, but what happens then is that strengthens that brain circuit so that then, not just when you're stressed, you reach for a cigarette, but when you're relaxed, you also reach for a cigarette because it's associated with relaxing, with the relief of stress. So it becomes hardwired in. So then you start craving a cigarette when you're comfortable. Or if you're an alcoholic, you start craving a drink when you feel happy. It's like, great, time for a drink. The two go together. So it gets hardwired in. It's psychological as well as with the physiology. And so what's tricky is that, yeah, the distress is momentarily relieved. That's true. So that's the short term, we get it, we get the hit. But in the long term, it's destructive for us. And so then, of course, so then that particular unhealthy cycle becomes strengthened. So then the next time the input comes in, what are we more likely to do? The same thing, a go around again, tighter and tighter. So this is familiar to us, isn't it? Where you recognize each of those stages. Probably the one we don't recognize is that first one of the input because it's just there all the time, this assault of modern day life. And maybe occasionally we have that feeling, oh, I just want to get away. That's kind of an indication of it. So what we can do to undo it. So deconstructing the habit cycle. Now, this is where it gets fun. All right. So this one. So for the input, okay, so instead of trying to change everything and everybody out there, which is what we spend a lot of our time doing, trying to change it all, trying to adjust things and get comfortable and all of that. So instead of that, as we wake up in the morning, set your motivation. So do that happiness journal. Actually, put in place the direction that you're going in a positive direction first from your own side rather than reacting to the circumstances. And even if it's waking up with a feeling of dread or anxiety, we can either panic about it or we can set our mind in a positive direction. So one thing that I do is I do say in a kindly way, ah, oh, hello, here's my old friend Dred. And so then we have a chat, and then I think, well, half of the things that I dread are legit, you know, like you just have to think about climate change, and that's a legitimate dread. And so rather than trying to push that away, that's a fact that we have to live with and do something about. So as uncomfortable as it is, I should actually keep it in my mind. Yeah, that's yes.
Awareness is in that
Awareness,
yeah.
yep. And so that's why I like that meditation that we did to start with, and just being aware of like our inner weather system is part of that practice. That's what it's for, so that we don't then run off and react to it. Yes, but to be able to become aware. And so even when we have dread or anxiety or any of those uncomfortable feelings, there is another way to respond to them, which is to use them to grow your compassion. So if you feel those terrible things, then instead of beating yourself up or trying to roughhouse yourself to get rid of the feeling, have some compassion and gentleness for yourself, and then also recognize, oh, other people have this too, and they're probably people I know, and I've got to remember to be gentle and kind to them too. So that whole experience can become a good thing if we set our motivation. So when it's setting our motivation, that's like the direction. We set it in that to not harm and to, where possible, help. And yes, so then the second one in the feeling, that's where the mindfulness comes in, to just pause. So we have the feeling and then don't panic. Dread, anxiety, crankiness, whatever it is, just pause before getting involved, especially before getting involved in the story. So one way that we can think about this mindfulness is notice and name. So notice the feeling and name it, and that's it. Don't do anything, don't judge it, just notice and name. And have some kind of space, which is why I put the pause button there, before reacting in any way. Even if it's just a space of a few seconds before you go, no. But a minute or two in the mindfulness part, where you have whatever the feeling or the experience coming up, and we know that it's a deceptive brain message, to just examine it. And again, this, like a weather system, like a weather reporter would examine what's happening there in the climate. What's happening over here? What's happening there? What happened beforehand? Where's it leading to? Just ex really analyze and examine it rather than being reactive. So if we manage to do this, and especially if in the morning we've set a good motivation, then when you're out and about and someone triggers you, what would normally trigger you, you've got this little bit of a habit to come up to pause, to notice a name. Oh, I'm about to get really annoyed. So notice name. That's it. That's all you have to do. And it stops a whole lot of things in their tracks. Then if you can feel it coming up, it's bubbling over, I'm going to say something, or I'm going to respond, then instead of the urge to relieve the discomfort, the discipline is the restraint. The restraint for, if you can, 15 minutes. So before you write the email, before you post the thing on social media, before you yell on the phone and hang up, whatever it is, just pause. Just wait. And so there's a trick I say to myself, yes, Miffy, you can do it. Just not yet. Sleep on it. Yes. Oh, that's really long. That one. That's all 24 hours. Oh my gosh. Yes, that's right. So you react because the deceptive brain message, because the feeling is bad, then it's 100% bad. Everything about it is bad. It's unbearable. And then we react on it. So, yes, sleep on it, wait, say yes, but I'll respond tomorrow, or whatever restraint that we can do. Any amount of restraint works. Neurologically, even just a few seconds will help rewire your brain so that the habit becomes stronger and stronger. So, at least 15 minutes though, and then when we do respond, the heat of the moment has gone out of it. So we're going to actually be able to respond instead of just be triggered. So the only way to do that is this restraint, discipline. Something that can encourage us is that restraint where you're going, "Whoa, I really want to say something, but I'm not saying anything." That discomfort and that tension is the actual process of your brain being rewired. So it's a good sign. So it's just like if you're doing weight training and your muscles start hurting or burning or whatever, that's a good sign. That means it's working. So that discomfort, that agitation, just sit with it, let it be. It's a good sign. And then when you do actually act, then you can do it after the urge has subsided. Never do it whilst the urge is there. So even with emails and social media and everything, you just wait till the urgency is gone, and then look at it again. And the next one is if all else fails and you're about to bust, change the channel and do something else. So that's like a Tai Chi move where, in martial arts, where the guy's coming at you and then they just flip him over. So the momentum's there. You don't stop the momentum. You just use the momentum to do something else. So here, instead of reaching for a cigarette, you reach for something, but it's going to be something like a really delicious fresh apple or a glass of water with ice in a beautiful crystal goblet or something. So you don't just sit there going, "No." The momentum's there. I'm about to reach for the cigarette, but I'm reaching for something else. That's if it works well, and it's probably something that you need to pre-prepare. You have to know what it is. What's this negative habit that has you in its grip that you want to change? What are the things that I can do to change the channel that are going to be enjoyable and long-term beneficial? So it's not a punishment. It's not go do something like whip yourself or go punish yourself by doing your tax return or something. It's about something that you love doing. So if you love crochet, or if you love the garden, or if you love walking the dog, or if you love ballroom dancing or whatever it is. But it can't just be something that you love, because what happens if you just love vodka, right? So it's got to be something that you love and that is long-term beneficial. That's the criteria. So it's not a punishment, but it's got to be long-term beneficial. So usually when things go wrong, you see it with parents and kiddies, especially when they're out and about, so you don't have everything at your disposal, all of your tricks to keep the kiddies happy. And so then it's just quick, shove something into the kiddie's face that will distract them. That's the change the channel thing. And then as we get older, then we do that as an adult in a slightly more sophisticated way. But things go wrong in life and we just change it. We just grab something else, a new hobby, a new person, have an affair, change jobs, whatever it is, we distract ourselves without doing these things beforehand. Usually this is the first thing that we go to, is the change of channel, the distraction. But it shouldn't be our first port of call. It's really the one where nothing else has worked. It's the last port of call. The other place where this really is helpful is once we're already upset, once we're already angry, you can't undo that. It has to run its course. So trying to say, "Oh, take a few breaths," or whatever like that, it's too late for that. It's already arisen. So that to use that momentum, Rather than, for instance, even just sitting and talking with someone, it's better to get up and walk, go for a walk and talk, so that there is some momentum there. Corey Jackson will talk about this when he comes on Tuesday nights in, I think it's in April, and also he's going to be leading a couple of other courses later on in the year. So this is called the refractory period. And in poker terms, it's called you're on tilt. And that's not the time to make a decision. And it's a tricky time. You're already on tilt. So you have to have something to do that's safe and beneficial. If we just have this one as the one that we rely on, we might be able to stop ourselves doing negative things, but we're not breaking any habit patterns. They'll still come up. The dissatisfaction and the panic will still come up again and again and again, and we'll just have to keep distracting ourselves. So what I've noticed, especially with people coming here, that maybe by the time you hit 40, maybe late 30s, 40, all of the things that you used to do to change the channel, like sport or drinking with your mates or whatever, they stop working. It doesn't do it anymore. Or you can't, you break a bone and so you can't do it anymore. Or you end up fighting with your drinking buddies or something. And so if this has been the only response to problems, you're in real trouble because we've got, nothing else there to be able to use. So it's the last resort one. So when I was giving up drinking, my last resort was to always have a really nice kind of crystal glass with the ice that goes ching, ching, ching. Because that sound, sounds nice, so I'm happy. And then a fish and a fisherman's friend. So then you have cold drink and a fisherman's friend, and it's just like instant ice cream headache. Yeah. So I just get like this rush. And so that was the instead of having a drink or a cigarette. And it would be as intense as having a vodka or a cigarette. And actually, come to think of it, with way less damage. It was just a few seconds instead of like the hangover and the whatever. So, but something, I had to have something to replace this. Otherwise, I'd just be obsessed with having a drink or a cigarette. So when I'd go out, I'd go out with a whole packet of fisherman's friends. I'd be ready. And so I did that for about a year until I was able to like cope being out without those props. Yeah. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have something else to do. Now I just have crochet. Now I get stressed, I just crochet straight away. So if we do that, then what happens? Brain circuits strengthen, yes, but all of our positive skills grow. So we have a good association. And that becomes something that we can rely on, and it becomes instinctual. So this is then when difficult situations arise, we can relax because we know our automatic response is going to be, before you take your photo, there's the rest of it. Is going to be a beneficial one. And of course, it's called a cycle of natural flourishing because it is a positive one. Then the next morning when we wake up, despite the input, we're going to be having a positive view of the world naturally. So that whole cycle strengthens. At any time, we'll be able to be working on one of these points. It's not like we can't do anything. There's always one of those that we can be working on. Yeah, indecision. So, yeah, so indecision can be a few things. One is that the uncomfortable feeling is committing to something and perhaps it being wrong or missing out. So that's what you're pushing away, that feeling. And so it's a negative habit because the indecision is taking away from something beneficial. and that, and underneath indecision is fear and attachment also. So the fear of uncertainty and being unable to control things, which is actually a legitimate fear because that's reality. But also there's an attachment of wanting things to be perfect. And so often we will just not make the decision until the thing is broken, and then it's too late. When it comes to decisions, actually, Eddie, there was one of the, I have to find out which of the self-help books, but it was one of the really classic ones, and an absolute gem of advice, which was, if the decision is something that can be easily changed or walked back, then just make the decision. You can always change it later. And if it's a decision that is a absolute huge consequences, then make that decision slowly. So what sometimes we end up doing is we've got this huge decision, like which house do I buy? And we get so overwhelmed, we just go, oh, whatever, and just get that one because it's too big. But actually, the bigger the decision, if we can't walk it back, then it's worth doing an analysis and writing a chart and going step by step and putting in the hard yards. If it's like, where should I go and rent, or should I go here or there on the holiday? Doesn't matter. Can always change your mind. So just as a way of even just breaking down how to make a decision, there's a spectrum there. Sometimes we don't know if the decision that we're making is a life and death decision or not. And a lot of these are to do with the negative habits too. So many, when it comes to drugs or alcohol, you don't think it's a life and death situation, and it ends up being a life and death situation. So handy hints when it comes to habits. Habits don't go away by themselves. If we leave our bad habits alone, they're just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So it is worth putting in the training to change them, and doing it in this way that we that it's a well-rounded actually changing of a habit. It's not what you think or feel that matters, but what you do. So especially in the beginning, it's not whether we feel comfortable or uncomfortable, whether we're miserable or happy, it's how we respond to it. That's the biggest thing that matters. Whether we panic and are reactive, whether we can just sit with it, sit with that feeling for even just a few seconds. Our feelings dominate us so much, and they really do a disservice. So it's not to dismiss those feelings, but it's not to be reactive about them. It's really important. So in the beginning, don't try and change your feelings. It's okay. Do that mindfulness meditation. Just notice and name and just sit with them. Practice sitting with them. And one way that we can kind of encourage ourselves is to recognize that pain is unpleasant, but it's important. So my blisters, if I had have noticed earlier on, then I wouldn't have had all those scars. And so many people push on through the pain and do an injury. So also emotionally too, if you find yourself getting stressed or anxious, that's a pain signal. That's an emotional pain signal, and it's to be listened to. What is it pointing to? So the stress, the anxiety, and the dread is pointing to something or pointing out something, and that's worth investigating. The stress and the dread and anxiety isn't the actual problem. It's the pain system. And so also emotions are emotional signals, so pay attention to them, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. And what we said last week, don't give up what you want most for what you want now. So this Oh, Madonna, delayed gratification, I know. Oh, woe is me. So, Lamia, she says, so no matter what sort of mental problem you experience, instead of getting nervous or fearful, sit back, relax, and be as silent as possible. In this way, you will automatically be able to see reality and understand the root of the problem. When we experience problems, either internal or external, our narrow, unskillful mind often makes them worse. When someone with an itchy skin condition scratches it, he feels some temporary relief and then thinks his scratching has made it better. In fact, the scratching has made it worse, and we're like that. We do the same thing every day of our lives. Instead of trying to stop problems like this, we should relax and rely on our skillful, silent mind. Okay, so Tina, while I do the little summary, can you make sure everyone has one of these,
A whole
just one
one
page each.
page.
Yeah. Okay. So relying on our skillful silent mind is because the nature of our mind is clean, clear, and pure, like the sky. So we can clean out the toxic emotions. Don't conflate the person with the behavior. And we can stop feeding the monster step by step. Dismantle it. So you've got the homework sheets, the reflection questions to do, but here is a little extra bit of homework. So you've got these dots. Now, I'm sorry, online people, I'd love to hand you the dots, but if you've got some prayer flags maybe around the house, this is a mindfulness exercise that you could do. So put these dots around your house, and every time you see your eye alights on a yellow dot, you have to pause and think of a happy memory. Every time your eye alights on a red dot, and there's only what, three there, so come on, you have to pause and remember a person who loves you. Bring them to mind. So stop doing whatever you're doing. And a green one, something that you're looking forward to. And a blue one of your qualities, an internal quality. So go around and distribute them around your house in various places. And going dotty is the exercise. So, as a way of just bringing our mind to these things, it's creating a habit. And eventually, if you've got lots of little prayer flags, you know, the prayer flags are these colors plus white, then you can just hang them up around and do it that way. Next week, we're going to have a look at how to fix our mistakes, and in general, the 10-point checklist, how to act, what to do and what not to do. Just real simple rule of thumb. The fixing the mistakes is when we look at all those disastrous habit patterns and all the things that we've done and regretted in our life, there is something we can do about it. Even if we can't fix the external mistake, we can fix what's happened in our mind. Yes, we can. So let's dedicate our merits, shall we? And take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Let everything settle into your mind. Everything we've talked about, like a beautiful rainfall of golden drops of light falling through the clear, luminous spaciousness of your mind. And fully appreciate the effort that you've put into tonight to come along, either online or in person to get here. The effort that you put into being a good human being, to actually looking after yourself to bring lasting happiness, and how this will be able to benefit everyone around you immediately, but also way into the long term, all the way to complete freedom or nirvana or enlightenment for oneself and others. And so appreciate those efforts and dedicate them for this big, vast goal, because it is possible. Okay. Thanks very much, everyone. And hope to see you next week for the next exciting installment.